This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today is our first Mondays with the Mayor with Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey. She is taking your questions and ours, so let's dive right in. The number is 1-800-423-8255 for your Boston-focused questions. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mayor Janey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
So it's been about a month in the job now. What has been the biggest
six
surprise?
Weeks? What's... Exactly.
Six
this
weeks.
Is the beginning of my seventh week. At some point, I'm going to lose count, but the beginning of my 7 week. Yes.
So happy anniversary on the beginning of your seventh week. What has surprised you? What has really you just didn't expect it?
I really appreciate and I'm deeply grateful for just the outpouring of support and excitement. Certainly the historic nature of me being the first Black mayor and the first woman mayor is still very exciting for our city and for the residents here. But beyond that, I think that people are really pleased with the work that I've been able to do in just 6 weeks. And so that has been certainly encouraging. There is no shortage, of course, of you know, various challenges and issues that need attention in the city. And so I'm, you know, grateful to have a great team here and building a team here that are addressing these issues and making sure that the residents of Boston are well served.
So I do have lots of policy questions for you, but this is our first Monday with the Mayor with you. So it's our first chance to really get to know you a little more as a person. And I have been thinking about how big this job is. You know, you raised your daughter, Kamisha, as a single mom. She has three children of her own now, ages 17, 13, and 6. What have your grandchildren said to you about what you're doing?
You know, I think on the one hand, they understand that this is a big deal and can appreciate it. On the other hand, I'm just Mima to them. Rosie lost a tooth over the weekend, one of her two front teeth. And I go by and I give her $1 for losing her tooth. You know, I'm just her Mima in many ways, even though I am the mayor. So, you know, I do this for them. I do this for all children in our city. I've been a child advocate for, you know, the vast majority of my career in making sure that we have a city where our children are safe, where our seniors are safe, where people can come together and experience all of the wonderful things that the city of Boston has, and that they feel welcome and included. Those things are all very, very important to me as someone who grew up here and, you know, saw when that wasn't always the case.
You have said that you originally wanted to be a nurse, and in fact, you were inspired by Diane Carroll's character on the 1960s show Julia. Now,
yeah.
You didn't go into nursing, and you didn't actually run for office for the first time until just about 5 years ago. So first, what drew you to nursing? And then, when did you know you were going to make the pivot to politics?
Yeah. Well, it was the show, Julia. So it was very, you know, as a little girl watching TV, you know, I didn't see a lot of people on television who looked like me. I saw this in Diane Carroll. Who was a nurse. She was a mom. She was widowed. She was raising her son, Corey, by herself. She wore her nurse's uniform, and she was helping people. She was well-respected. And I thought, you know, I wanted to be like Julia. I wanted to be a nurse. Ultimately, I realized that I wanted to help people. I grew up in a family of educators, artists, entrepreneurs, and advocates, where, you know, a strong commitment to community, where public service was important. Even if it wasn't elected office, that was very important in my family. I saw a lot of activism growing up in the 1970s and 80s, and I became a community organizer. I became an advocate. I started doing community organizing for Parents United for Child Care in the mid-1990s after having done some work with the Children's Defense Fund, organizing freedom schools. I then went on to Mass Advocates for Children, another nonprofit, in 2001, where I led their work around education policy and really focused on equity and excellence in education and helping to support our young people develop their own voice to advocate for policies that impact their lives directly, as well as including parents and teachers in that work. And it was there that I really felt the call to run for public office, to take this advocacy to a bigger stage, to have a greater impact. So I ran for city council. I was successful in that race and became the first woman to represent District 7. Later then, in the next term, became the council president, elected by my peers on the city council, of the most diverse city council in Boston's history, which was just amazing, for the first time ever having a majority women council and a majority people of color council. And then early this year, President Biden taps then Mayor Walsh to become the United States Secretary and became the first woman and first black mayor of our great city. So it has been a whirlwind of activism, of advocating, of, pushing all of us to create better opportunities. And what is really clear to me, as we are now more than a year into battling COVID-19, and has been clear since last year, is we can't go back, that going back is income inequality. It's mass incarceration. It's a wealth gap of $250,000. It is a housing crisis. It is so many issues. That's what normal represents. And so I want us to go better. And my vision as mayor is to create a Boston, a stronger Boston, a Boston that is more equitable, more just, and more resilient.
So you mentioned the pandemic, which, of course, it's everywhere. It's what we think about all the time. Let's move into some policy now around that. You have decided to delay Boston's reopening plans by 3 weeks over what the schedule the Commonwealth has now put out. What led you to make that decision?
Well, we are continuing to be informed by the data, putting the care of our residents first and foremost, making sure that now that we are just less than 2 weeks of having everyone, or just about the two-week mark of having everyone over 16 eligible, that we have more time to get vaccines in people's arms. We are going to be informed by the data. Fortunately, we are trending in the right direction, and so we want to continue to do what is working. And we have seen a decrease by 48% over a two-week time period. And we continue to make progress on getting residents vaccinated. More than 61% of Boston residents over the age of 16 have received at least one dose of the vaccine. But we have to do much more in our hardest hit neighborhoods and with our vulnerable population. So we've got a lot of our seniors vaccinated, which is great, and we know that they were very vulnerable and disproportionately impacted at the beginning of this pandemic. But we know throughout the pandemic that the Black and Latino community have been disproportionately impacted in terms of positive cases as well as deaths in our city. And so while we will continue to protect residents, we are also promoting our businesses. Our businesses are open. We have our capacity limits have increased. So, we have already increased for outdoor and indoor. Our restaurants don't have capacity limits at all. They do have to space their tables, and we've accommodated making sure that they can, reach a fuller capacity by giving them support around some outdoor dining options. And we will continue to be informed by the data. And should the data suggest that we need to pull back and maybe get a little tighter, we will. If it suggests that we can loosen up and open things up even more widely, then that's what we will do. But we will make sure that we are. Yeah.
Let's take a call. I'm sorry. I'm anxious to get to a bunch of things, and we do have a couple callers on the line. So 800-423-8255. We've got Colin on the line. Colin is in Bridgewater now. Colin, go ahead.
Hi. Great to be here on the radio show. Thank you so much for fielding the questions and doing this program. I think it's such a great thing. My question for you was, how do you plan on implementing greater trust in the vaccination process as a result of the data showing that willingness to get vaccinated in other states, but somewhat in Massachusetts, has shown that maybe there's some trust or lack of trust in the vaccination process? Is there any plan on the part of yourself as the mayor to help restore public faith in the vaccination and state plans?
Yes, great question, Colin. Thank you for that. You know, we are doing everything we can to continue to ensure that there is good information out there from trusted sources so that people can make informed decisions about the vaccine. Certainly making opportunity for folks who are ready to get the vaccine, whether that's time, you know, off of work to do so, making sure that we are meeting people where they are. We have found that has been very successful here in Boston, not always expecting people to come to mass sites, but going directly to them, whether that be a community center, whether that be a church, whether that be a senior building. And we've launched the HOPE campaign, which is very much focused on getting information out in different languages, you know, particularly if there is hesitancy there, as well as in my very first week, I launched a vaccine equity grant of $1.5 million, which seeks to have our public health folks partner with trusted community partners who have these relationships that can help us where there might be some hesitancy. And we just announced the awardees last week, and so doing continual work on that front, and we'll continue to push to make sure we're building trust and getting the vaccine into more arms.
Let's stay with the vaccines for a minute. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey is arguing that the state should require public employees like state police, for example, correctional officers, to get the coronavirus vaccine. Have you considered or would you consider such a mandate for city employees?
Well, you know, at this point, I really want to do everything possible to encourage people to take the vaccine, to get the information they need so that they can make an informed decision for themselves and their families, and then to make the vaccine accessible to them. And then, you know, give them the time needed to take off to get the vaccine. And even if they have, you know, a symptom from the second shot, like some folks might get a fever, a slight fever afterwards, if they need to take a day to recuperate, I want to do everything possible to make sure that people can make informed decisions and that this isn't forced upon them.
Might
you know,
we
and I
reach
understand.
A point there where it would become necessary, especially if you have public-facing employees and we're not yet at herd immunity?
I will continue to be informed by the data and see where we are. I think, you know, there is a point where, you know, we might reach a point where folks who want the vaccine have already had it, and maybe that there are some other folks who are less anxious and will continue to be less anxious. And I think that goes beyond city employees. I think that is across the city, across the Commonwealth, across the country, that people still have some questions. And I think the best way to battle hesitancy is by providing good information. A lot of people are getting information off the internet and watching YouTube videos that might have, you know, false information. So I think, you know, ensuring that we have a way of getting info out from trusted sources so that people can make informed decisions for themselves and their families is the right approach right now.
Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255, to ask your Boston question of Kim Janey. We have Dorothy on the line from Jamaica Plain. Dorothy, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor Janey. I have reached out to your office as city councilor and also as mayor. I'm sure you're aware of the emails and the videos that the constituents have been sending, and we're concerned, and I'd like to know, what is your plan to deal with the growing crowds of dirt bikers around Franklin Park, as well as the middle-of-the-night speaker parties? There is a public meeting, as your office is aware of, tomorrow night, being hosted by Councilor O'Malley's office, as well as the Franklin Park Coalition. And what
let's take it back from you there, Dorothy, so that Mayor Janey can answer the focal point of the question. Thank you for that call. Mayor Janey, go ahead.
Thank you. So Dorothy, I appreciate the call, and like you, here the dirt bikes. I live close to main roads right off of Warren, very close to Blue Hill, and I hear the bikes as well. I just spoke with our chief about this issue just last night. As the weather gets warmer, we know that this will continue to be a challenge. I'm not sure if you are aware, we do have a no chase, no pursuit policy, you know, as it relates to police officers, you know, going after folks on their dirt bikes, because it poses more of a risk and more danger, not only to the person on the dirt bike, to the police officers, but to civilians. The police do have a strategy and have been working on a strategy to, you know, get these bikes off the road. So if you know of anyone that has them, oftentimes they are not legally registered, and therefore we're able to kind of get them off the road. So if you do see them, please continue to report them, so that we can get them off the road. That is the best way that we can cut this down. And as well as folks, if, you know, we see them in someone's backyard, you know, talking to our neighbors and hoping that folks will do the right thing on that front. I, you know, understand completely that this is a nuisance for many of our residents, particularly when this happens late at night, and it poses a risk to everyone on our roads.
You mentioned law enforcement there, so let's pivot to some questions there. There are a few things I want to ask you about policing, because it seems like issues around police oversight and reform have really been front and center in the last few weeks, really during these first 6 weeks of your tenure or so. I understand the final report into allegations of domestic violence against Police Commissioner Dennis White has been submitted to this, to City Hall. The Boston Globe is reporting that. Is that correct, and have you had the opportunity to read it yet?
So, yes, it's correct that the final report from the independent investigator did arrive late last week. And so over the weekend, I have not had a chance to be fully briefed yet. My schedule was jam-packed on Saturday and Sunday. I will be taking time this week and perhaps into early next week into making sure that I am briefed so that I can make an informed decision. The last thing that I want to do is rush this decision. We are in the situation in large part because there was a rushed decision. So I want to make sure that I'm doing my due diligence, that I, you know, am briefed, that I know what's in this report, and that I make an informed decision from there.
If you can, what kinds of information are you looking for in the report? Not specifics, but what types of information do you need to know in order to be able to make some decisions? What are you looking for?
Well, the nature of the report, and again, this all was put in motion before, you know, I became mayor, so I didn't even get to say here's what the scope should be, and not completely clear of what it was, but I think my understanding of it is it's to understand these allegations that were brought up about, you know, incidents that happened in the past. And so I will certainly want to understand more of that. You know, these are very serious allegations. I've said, you know, from the start that I take them very serious even before I was sworn in as mayor. And I want to make sure that I'm doing my due diligence and not rushing. So, you know, I would expect, you know, it will be at least another few days and potentially into early next week before there is more information or a decision on that front.
Do you have the first of those briefings scheduled at this point?
We will definitely be looking at that this week for sure with the team and with the law department and the rest of the team.
So the Globe just filed a lawsuit against the police department Friday, arguing that it's wrongly keeping secret internal investigative files of others accused of domestic violence or sexual assault. You recently authorized the release of part of the investigation into former Boston police officer Patrick Rose. We've covered that a lot here on our show. He's accused of sexually assaulting multiple children. The files show internal investigators found credible evidence that he committed a crime. In the new suit, the Globe says there are other cases involving officers accused of sexual assault or domestic violence, but the department won't release information citing this legal right to privacy for the victims, which we know is a concern. Do you believe the department should be publishing these files with the identifying information redacted, and do you intend to push them to release more reports as you did with the Rose case?
Yeah. So I would say this, that accountability, transparency, so very important to build trust here in the city of Boston. And we know that this issue of accountability and transparency is playing out all across our country. You know, what happened in the Rose case should never, ever happen again. I have invested $1 million in the creation of the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency because I believe that this is important, an important step in terms of building trust. I have already done, in my first 6 weeks in office, more to release files, to be transparent than anyone that I can think of in recent history. And I think certainly more files should come to light, is what I have asked our new executive director, who just started today, Stephanie Everett, to be looking into, you know, certainly starting with the Rose case. But even beyond that, I think, you know, transparency is where we need to be going with this. And at all costs, we do need to protect victims and survivors in these cases. We don't want, one, to jeopardize the identity of survivors. And I have been determined to protect the survivors in the Rose case and any other case. One, it's certainly mass law, but it is also a moral obligation that I have, that we all have, in terms of protecting survivors. And we do not want to deter other victims of abuse from coming forward in the future because they're worried that their name, that their information, and what happened to them will somehow end up on the front page of a newspaper or just on social media or wherever, you know, become office gossip. And so it is really important that we understand how these cases were handled. You know, was there attempt to suppress? You know, why didn't this stuff come out sooner? But we also have to balance that with protecting survivors in this case.
All right. I'm sure in that that's we'll be talking more about policing in future conversations. We have a little less than a minute left. So just briefly, what are you going to do for Mother's Day, your first one as mayor of Boston?
Oh, well, thank you. I certainly will participate in the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute's Mother's Day Walk. It's virtual this year. But I will participate in that. I hope to smell some lilacs. I hope to spend some time with my mother. I certainly hope to spend some time with my daughter, who's a mother. And I certainly wish every mother out there and every caregiver of children who are in the role of mother a happy, safe, and healthy, and loving, joyful Mother's Day this year.
That is Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey and our first Monday with the Mayor with Mayor Janey. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll look forward to doing it again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
This past year has taken its toll on everyone, so we want to start the week this week by bringing you some unbridled joy, a lovely conversation from a little deeper into our Radio Boston archive. I want you to picture it, October 2019, pre-pandemic, when local authors, comedians, artists, musicians, they used to actually come into Studio 3. They'd sit across the table from us, and they'd make us feel and smile and sometimes laugh. One of those visitors was John Hodgman. You know him, PC from the infamous PC and Mac commercials, the deranged billionaire on Jon Stewart's Daily Show, host of his own podcast, and an author. And John Hodgman joined us in Studio 3 to talk about his latest book, Medallion Status, and his adjustment from TV show stardom to being slightly less famous.
Yeah, right. Ask me anything. I know a lot of things, and what I don't know, I will make up.
Yeah, we've learned that.
Yes. Although now I'm telling the truth, mostly. I don't tell fake facts anymore the way I used to do on The Daily Show, because everyone's doing it now.
I was going to say, it's kind of not your shtick anymore.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's been taken over by many high-level government officials, so, I just try to tell the truth.
So in Medallion Status, this comes on the heels of Vacation Land, but now you're taking us down this other memory lane to explore your true life experiences in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Would you just wake up one day and say, this is what I want to write about?
No, you know, I can only present the stories that I have, and my story is an odd one. I mean, it's good that I'm on radio. Anyone who looks at me says, oh, he should not be on camera. He looks like a weird man baby with an ugly beard.
Wait, what are you saying about people who are on radio?
Well, I'm not saying anything. You should be on camera. Everyone. I'm just saying that my career on camera was wildly implausible. I started as a writer of humor for the internet. I wrote a humor book, got me on The Daily Show as a guest. That got me on The Daily Show as a contributor, that put me onto the Apple ads, that sent me on this strange career doing guest spots as various mustache creeps on different shows like Bored to Death or Mozart in the Jungle and so on. It was a completely unexpected career in acting that I hadn't trained for, that I had to get better at very quickly. You know, there is a thing called imposter syndrome. Everyone, even the most accomplished people, feel like they're faking it and are about to be found out. Sometimes you are faking it. And it's a gift to be found out and be taken aside and going, you're not doing a good job.
Well, let's talk about these evil mustache guys for
yes.
a minute. Because I was cracking up from the beginning of the book, because very early on in the book, we start talking nudity. And who knew you were going to do that?
I certainly did not expect that there would be I would have to sign a rider to my contract explaining how nude I was going to get.
That's right.
On Mozart in the Jungle. And it says right at the top of the rider, nude rider, which is like two words I had never thought I would put together in my life.
Or a new kind of superhero, yes.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm yes. reading it, and you're talking about the fact you're getting all prepared for it. You're negotiating it out. They want you to wear this kind of nude-colored sock.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, why?
I had my choice of privacy garments.
Right. Right.
They were very intricate privacy garments, and they were all ridiculous, because even the quote-unquote Caucasian-colored ones were 1,000 times more bronzed and healthy-looking than my skim milky pallor.
So you decide the right answer, then, is to just say, hey, why don't I skip it entirely and just be naked?
Yes. Well, I wanted to dive in. I had learned that when life offers you interesting opportunities, say yes to them. And so I was like, let's go ahead and show the world the nude male monster that I am.
But as you point out, they did not say yes to that.
No, the director was like, we would not like to traumatize the entire the entire crew. You can wear that sock.
So by the time I get to the end of the chapter, and I'm wheezing because when I laugh too hard, I get asthma.
I'm so sorry to hear
that. It's all right.
I have my
inhaler
with me in case you need it.
Well, I might by the end of this. It turns out what you're trying to say is I'm going to lay myself bare in this book.
Yes. The book is about what it's like to have a life as a very famous minor television personality and all the strange secret rooms and first-class lounges and exclusive parties you get in, admitted to, even with the minorest of fame, and then what it feels like to get kicked out of them one by one till you're not even as famous as the least famous corgi on Instagram.
So we'll come back to the corgis, because
yes.
also funny. But there is a sadness to the arc of this book. You sound like you're grieving something a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Being on television's great. Everyone's nice to you. You get snacks. You know,
everyone here will tell you I'm a big fan of snacks.
Sure. And of course, especially if you did not expect to ever be on television, I got to enjoy it as much as a tourist as anything else and see into this strange world. Our status depletes over time.
So
you lose a job. Anyone might lose a job and you feel like, who am I anymore?
So why stop doing it? There is nostalgia. You lost some of the perks. You've moved down from your platinum status.
That's right. Yes.
So
the medallion status part of the book refers to my obsession with a certain airline's loyalty rewards program.
Beloved airline.
Yes. I would not name the airline in the book because they're not giving me money. So I refer to them as beloved airlines and chasing not just gold or platinum, but diamond medallion status. As my status in culture tended to go down, I became more and more obsessed with getting this imaginary medallion. And a diamond medallion is dumb, right? I mean, you can understand why there would be a gold medallion in the world, but
right.
carving a diamond into a round disc is just a good way to ruin a diamond.
All right. So is there anything more existential than snacks that you miss about the fame that you had?
Well, you know, the gift of fame, especially television fame, is that people will stop you on the street. And sometimes they'll be scared because they're like, oh, you're a weird ghost from television. But most of the time, and I'm very grateful, people would say, I like what you do. And that's a very powerful feeling. And a lot of people, to be seen that way, most people aren't seen or recognized on the street or even in their own families. That is the sort of thing that it is hard to let go of. No one wants to be anonymous. You know, not everyone wants to be famous. And what I've discovered is that, you know, all you can do is give yourself fully to the world and the experience of this world, to tell your story as nakedly as possible, covering yourself with a privacy garment or two, and throw yourself on the mercy of the world, and interesting things come back.
You're not anonymous. There are twice as many people in the control room right now as there usually are
yes.
for any segment I record yes. in Radio Boston.
And it's important that they do not make eye contact with me when I leave this room.
So,
no, of course not. I just mean to say that, you know, there are moments in time when you get stripped bare, whether it's for a nude scene on Mozart in the Jungle, or you lose your job and you lose the status that comes with that job, or someone dumps you and you have to rethink, who am I? You know, I thought that we were in love or we're not. There are moments when you're humiliated and you're told you're faking it, you're not doing a good job. And all I want to say is that humiliation is a good process to go through.
Why?
You learn who you are. You learn what you look like inside.
So who are you?
You look like to other people.
Who have you learned you are?
Oh, well, I'm someone who has a very popular podcast, and maybe that's what I should have, the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I'm a dad, you know, I'm a writer. I'm pretty good at being an actor on television, but not the greatest. I'd love to go back, but I'm happy to see what else this weird fate offers me.
So some of the more poignant moments are when you explore what it means to be famous and juxtapose yourself with other models of fame. So let's go back to the dogs.
Yeah. Well, right?
Tell us the story about Linus and Chomp.
Sure. So I perform my imitation of stand-up comedy. I'd been at the San Francisco Sketchfest Comedy Festival and hadn't been invited to a very exclusive party hosted by Adam Savage, the former Mythbuster, who's got a private workshop where he replicates all these science fiction and fantasy props. He's got a Han Solo frozen in carbonite. He's got an Admiral Akbar dressed up in Russell Crowe's Napoleonic Wars uniform from Master and Commander. It's a wild scene, especially if you're an asthmatic nerd like me. I was so excited to be there and see all my comedy friends in this exclusive party. And then I saw these two people standing holding these two corgi dogs and getting all this attention, and it made me mad. I was like, why are those dogs getting more attention than me? That's a weird, I don't recognize them from comedy. Who are they? I said to my friend. And he said, who invited the guy? I said, who invited the guys with the corgis? He said, oh, they weren't invited. The corgis were invited. They're Linus and Chompers, two famous corgis of Instagram.
Kind of really famous.
They're really famous. Chompers has a manager. Chompers has co-sponsorship deals. And this is the tip of the iceberg, I've learned. There's a whole universe of famous corgis and other dogs on the internet that are far more famous than I will ever be. And that's when I realized I don't know what entertainment is anymore.
So do you now? I imagine the book, you kind of finished the drafts and sent it into the publisher months and months ago. Have you been reflecting on that? What does it mean to be famous?
Well, I mean, what you want it to be is that you tell a story that resonates with people and they enjoy it and they can say so. What you don't want it to be is sort of full-bore immersion therapy and sociopathy, where everything in your life is catered to with so much affirmation that you don't know who to believe anymore and no one will tell you the truth about yourself. I mean, it's a good thing that I don't have a face for television per se. Character actor, fine. But like, I learned from being on television that however nice and decent I am in the world, people will cast me as creepy villains all the time. That's just how I look to the world. And in many different ways, fame reflects back on you how the world sees you. And you can either learn from that or you can pretend that it's not true. And I'd rather learn from it.
Kevin from Amesbury, you are on the line with John Hodgman.
Thanks for having me on, Judge.
Thank you very much, Kevin. How are you?
Be in your presence. I'm calling because I've been a fan of your work for a long time.
Thank you.
I'm a huge fan of the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
Thank you.
You seem to have a really amazing, strong moral sensibility for like a silly internet podcast. I was just curious as to like where you think that moral framework, how that was developed. Has there been any sort of intentionality to its development?
So the podcast you refer to, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, you can Google it if you want. It started as a joke about 9 years ago. My friend said, do you want to do like a Judge Judy show, but for a podcast where people call in with minor disputes about how they, you know, how they load the dishwasher or whether a hot dog is a sandwich. And friends and spouses and
it
siblings.
Is not, by the way.
Thank you. That is very refreshing to hear.
Just saying.
I don't want to hijack this whole conversation.
Right,
this
fair enough. Kevin is still listening.
Takes up about 30% of my life now. But there are people yelling at the radio right now.
That's okay.
You're wrong, everybody. And, you know, I wanted to do it mostly because I wanted to present myself to the world rather than the sort of the exaggerated version of myself that people knew from The Daily Show, the deranged millionaire, the resident expert. I wanted to show them who I was, not necessarily to be funny, but to interview people and hear about their lives all over the world and then tell them who's right and who's wrong, because I do have a very strong sense. But I've learned from it. I mean, it's been 9 years of hearing disputes between people, and what I've learned is that in heterosexual male-female married couples, dude is almost always wrong. I never thought that was true. I always thought it's touch or go, but I have a lot of data points now. Guys have weird systems in marriages for how to load the dishwasher, and they're usually wrong.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to take one more call. Ellen from Lowell. Ellen, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just saying that, how are you doing? I appreciate what you're saying. I'm not famous or anything, But I was in grad school on full academic scholarship, and then I developed epilepsy.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And I was raised to believe that I had to be picture perfect and come across as impressive, but that I finally learned that it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
And I got much less stage fright and much less hassles just because I decided that it was okay not to be okay.
Yeah, I really appreciate that story, and I think you raised something really important, which is people tend not to appreciate that life needs to be messy, and you're going to take body blows, literally to your body, you know, sometimes. And if you can embrace those changes and get back to who you are as a core person, it's actually a relief. It's a relief. I'm glad you're not suffering, or I hope you're not suffering, and I'm glad you've got everything under control. But it sounds like that journey into unpredictability and a change in life actually is one that was beneficial to you. Yes, no, I hope.
I think we may have lost
it. It was beneficial,
Yay.
Especially when my husband wasn't freaked out by it.
Yeah, that's...
We met when the whole thing happened, and...
But you and your husband, met during this process?
Overqualified.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, Ellen. I was just saying you and your husband met during this health issue in your life?
Yes.
And he's still with you?
Yes. Yes.
There we go.
And we've been married almost 31 years.
Congratulations. That's a perfect counter data point to all of the... over-controlling dudes I talk to on my podcast. Good job.
All right, so we don't have a ton of time left.
That's fine.
My instinct was to have you read something. Is that something that you'd like to do? Because you're such a good writer.
Whatever you would like.
All right, let's have you read a little bit. There is a swear word in the passage we picked. Please don't say it.
Oh, sure. I will go over it.
All right, and I may stop you before the end of the passage. We'll see. But why don't you do a little reading for us? This is from a chapter where you're talking about Disney jail, and
yes.
You're discussing babies and what happens when you hide your hands behind your face.
Yeah, right. So... I'm talking about peekaboo. I'm not sure if anyone ever heard of this game before. Peekaboo confuses the babies, but not for long. They may think, oh, so sad, bye-bye forever face. But babies get on with their lives. They get right back into it, pushing their tongues out and growing their brains and pooping their pants until, oh, peekaboo face is back! And then they are scared out of their minds. What witchery is this, science has shown babies to think. But as fear always leads to laughter, except in cases of death or maiming, so the baby's terror eases into the relief and growing understanding that face is not back. Face was always there. Ha ha, say the babies. Face will always be there for me. Turns out it's hands that are the jerks. Who saw that plot twist coming? Not me. I'm just a baby. Oh, look, face is laughing now. This is a fun game, I guess. I wonder what... Ah, face, where are you?
Let's... Sorry, I've read that like 17 times. It still makes me laugh.
Great, I'm so glad.
So I wanted to also get to this point because we have a little time left. Your children figure into your decision making.
Right. Well, I talk about peekaboo because what I discovered as I was flying back and back and forth across the country for this television comedy that I was on, that's how I was getting all these medallion qualifying miles on beloved airlines, was that my children missed me. And that was not something that had happened during much of their early their early life, right? But because as babies, they developed a sense of object permanence. And they knew that I was gone, but I would be coming back. But then what happens when kids get older, and my kids started hitting preteen years, was they started noticing I was gone. And they started noticing changes in their own life as they approached the change of the preteen years, where they become little werewolves. And they see and they know that their bodies are changing. Then they wonder, maybe dad's not coming back. And it was heartbreaking to have to say over and over again, I have to go away again. And my son, who was 11 at the time, would go for work. And most of the time I would say, yes. But one time I had to say, no, I have to go get an imaginary medallion across the country because I'm so close to Diamond Medallion. It was a really hard conversation to have with a child.
Yeah. So last question, just briefly. You seem to me to be a man at peace. Are you a man at peace?
As much as an anxious only child from Brookline can be, yeah. You know, I think it was an incredible adventure that I got to have, and one that I'm still having. But I do feel more comfortable talking to people, you know, about their journeys through epilepsy and why that first guy is probably a nice guy, but all husbands are creeps on my podcast.
That's comedian and author John Hodgman with us back in October of 2019, talking about his book Medallion Status. The NHL and the NBA playoffs, they're both slated to start later this month, and so far, It looks promising for both the Celtics and the Bruins. Meanwhile, on Thursday, the Pats drafted a quarterback in the first round for the first time since 1993. And the Red Sox, well, let's just say so far they are worlds better than we expected. But are they World Series contenders? And what about the other teams? Who's best poised to bring a title back to Titletown in a year where, seriously, we could use some more victories? Well, here to help us check the score is Radio Boston's Chris Siderek. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana. It's okay. You can tell him I made you call Boston Titletown. That's fine.
Yeah, you did. It's okay. Although I don't mind it, but I want to know if we're going to have it again. So let's start with a lightning round, Chris. I'm going to run through the four major teams. You tell me, pretender or contender. In other words, do they have a real chance to win a championship? You want to do that?
This is great. I love it. It's like I'm on Around the Horn. Let's go.
All right. Let's start with the Red Sox. Go.
Ooh, that's the hardest one. I'm going to say contenders. I probably should double down on my bad preseason take that this team is going to be awful. They have legitimate questions left to answer, but you can't deny the start, right? They're in first place in their division. They started the year 9-3. I'm going to say they're contenders. Eternal optimist here.
And I promise we will come back to your bad pregame take.
So I figured we probably would.
All right. Celtics, contenders or pretenders?
Oh, this one hurts. I have to say pretenders here. I really want to say this is a team. I know. I want to say they're contenders. They have the talent to be contenders. They should be. But to quote President George W. Bush, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me. Nobody's going to fool again.
All right. I never thought we'd hear that quote again. Okay, so how about the Bruins?
It's a golden one. So the Bruins,
I think
is our best shot here to see a title in Boston again soon. I'm calling them contenders.
Really?
They are really hitting their stride right now, and it's at the right time. They look dangerous. They look like a team with chemistry. I think they are going to be something to watch as we head into the postseason in just about a week.
So you would rank them most contendery?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment. Yeah, I think so. Remember, this
Pats?
Is a team. Yeah, we'll come back to them later. Pats, I would say, are pretenders. And I'm going to say that because I know Bill Belichick is better at generating bulletin board material than anyone else in the world. And I want to give them something to get fired up about and prove me wrong. So I'm going to say they're terrible. They're not going to compete. And hopefully, you know, maybe they will use that as some fuel for the fire.
All right, so there, Bill Belichick, if you're listening, Chris has thrown down.
That's right.
All right, so now that we're done with our lightning round, you got kind of a mixed bag here. You say you think our biggest contenders are the Bruins, so, you know, make your case.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. They have a good core here, and they also have momentum. I mentioned, if you look back a year ago, it feels like a decade ago, but about a year ago, this was a team that heading into the pandemic had the best record in the league. They looked like they were ready to, the year before they had been in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals. They looked ready to defend that loss. So they have looked hungry, and they also made an acquisition at the trade deadline, which I always love. They brought in Taylor Hall to play on David Krejci's line, and it has made a big difference. David Krejci hasn't put a ton of goals in lately, but he has really stepped up on his assist game, basically making that pass right before a guy gets the goal. And he had 3 assists in the game on Saturday when the Bruins beat the Buffalo Sabres 6-2, including this fantastic pass to Craig Smith that led to Smith's 3rd goal of the game.
To Smith, the redirection, and Craig Smith has the hat trick. What a dish from Krejci. I think it's safe to say that this line has chemistry.
So I love the in-season move to bring in Taylor Hall. They didn't have to give up a ton to get him, but I think even more important than what you gave up is the fact that it shows the mindset. They're saying, we think we're close. We're going to bring in a piece that we think might help put us over the edge. And I think that is a thing that really can become contagious in the locker room and you start to buy in. So I love the way this team looks right now. I think they are going to be really fun to watch. And I've said it before, there's nothing more fun and exciting in sports than NHL playoff hockey.
Okay, so stay with this for a second. I know there's some other stuff to cover, but I saw that video clip. It was usually hockey for me is an inscrutable flurry of sticks, but even I could see that was brilliant. So now that you've said this could be fun for the non-regular hockey watcher, give them some way to tune into a couple of these games. What do they look for and how can they have some fun with this team?
So it's really interesting. We've talked about chemistry and how that plays out on the team level in basketball a lot. We haven't talked about it a ton in hockey, because in hockey, it's more about the line chemistry. So, and this is what bringing Taylor Hall in has allowed this team to do, is they're matching players up to try to bring out the best skills in each other. So basically, you elevate the play of the guys on the ice with you at the time. And I think we've seen that bringing in another offensive threat like Taylor Hall has really kind of ignited this offense. They're scoring goals. And just really, it's the speed of playoff hockey, which is so amazing. You'll see these guys flying up and down the ice nonstop, and they definitely elevate it to another level come playoff time, simply because it's unsustainable over the course of a regular season to play at the pace that they do in the playoffs. So it's just really fun to watch, but man, you're going to be on the edge of the seat the whole time. So buckle up. It's maybe it's slightly nauseating as well as super exciting.
Really selling it there, Chris. All right. So there is the potential ecstasy, and now you have given us the agony about the Celtics. So tell us a little bit more there.
Yeah, I mean, we're just talking about chemistry. The Celtics, we've talked all year, really have not been able to find that chemistry with each other. It's been such an up and down year, and really the last few days showed that too. On Friday night, you have the team down 32 points against the Spurs, and they make an incredible comeback. Jason Tatum puts up 60 points, ties a Larry Bird franchise record for the Celtics, and they win in overtime. So you think, okay, they can ride that momentum and keep building that. But come Sunday, they drop one to the Portland Trailblazers, who admittedly are a tough team that are playing well right now. But it was really – the Celtics just looked pretty disjointed, and then kind of some trouble down the stretch with about 40 seconds left. Game's out of hand. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown collided. Here's what that sounded like.
Man, this is not a good sign. You have both of our stars on the ground. All right, this is not what I want to see. Get the ball in. Jaylen Brown goes for the steal. Oh, man, they kicked each other.
Yeah, exactly right. And Brown is going – right to the locker room.
So that's trouble, obviously. Those are your two best players. Yeah. Brown was limping off the court. He had already had a sprained ankle going into that. And also the schedule is trouble here. Even at full strength, though, I'm not sure this team has the mental toughness. Prove me wrong. I dare you.
All right. So, I mean, the sound there told us the whole story. All right. Literally back to lightning round. 10 seconds. You said the Sox weren't going to be great, and they're looking pretty good. So what's the deal?
All right, I'm going to borrow a trademark phrase from sports writer Bill Simmons, the nobody believes in us theory. Basically, if everybody says you're terrible, that itself can be enough for a team to really rally behind and pull everyone together in the locker room and help guys play above their ability. I think that's a bit of what you're seeing here. As I said, there are still questions. We'll come back to it. I'm cautiously optimistic, so we'll see what happens.
All right, we'll keep watching it with you. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick helping us check the score. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Tiziana.
And listeners, that is Radio Boston Monday. We are a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.